This is Climate Autumn, and I'm your host, Julie Hantman, coming to you live from the Tacoma Radio Studio here in Tacoma Park, Maryland. Just like the summer records that we hit, lately we've had the warmest autumns on record. So autumn is a short season right now. Foliage is changing later. But more importantly, insects live longer, and that's beginning to cut into yields from key crops, including here in the U.S., and there's other impacts too. This autumn is tense, because on October 8th, the UN issued the most dire statement on climate change we've ever heard. This was a report called Global Warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius by the IPCC, which is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The report said we need to work even harder and faster than anyone truly thought we had to and halt global warming at 1.5 degrees maximum, and we need to accomplish this in the next 12 years. The report says by switching fast to clean energy and taking other steps, we could stave off some portion of the expected inundation of coasts, loss of species, etc. We can't address it all here on community radio, but we can do two things. Let's see how Maryland and DC are doing, our region. Are they on the right path when it comes to converting to clean energy? And how can we get involved? And how can we reduce the freakouts? We are going to look at some novel ways that arts and culture initiatives might help. My first guest is Mike Tidwell, a longtime Tacoma Park resident known to many of our local listeners. He's founder and executive director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network, or CCAN. And Mike will talk about some hopeful developments in policy in Maryland, DC, and Virginia. Then we've got two guests from the arts and culture sphere of things. Jill Cubitt broke out of a career in climate organizing and policy to co-found a project called Dear Tomorrow. Jill urges people to write letters to the future, and we're going to read some of those letters later on. Lastly, Noelle Kasowitz is a Miami and DC-based visual artist who recently floated down the Potomac on her artwork, and I will let her explain her very cool project later on. Let's start with Mike Tidwell of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network.
Well, first of all, it's great to be here, WOWD, in Tacoma Park, and to be with you, Julie. Congratulations on the new show. It's fantastic. So it does seem to be like a dark time at the federal level. We don't need any reminders of that. But the bottom line is we have 50 states in the United States. And if you look at California, if you look at New York State, if you look at some of the New England states, they're more like Europe when it comes to energy and climate change. California is moving toward 100% renewable energy probably by the year 2040. We've got the upper Midwest. Minnesota is just bringing on so much wind power and solar, and then across New England. But the good news for those of us who live in Tacoma Park is that Maryland and the district and Virginia are moving forward on these issues. DC is probably going to pass before the end of this year a bill mandating 100% renewable energy by the year 2032 and building efficiency standards like we've never seen before, excise taxes on electric cars dismissed, really good policy. And Maryland is moving toward a very ambitious policy of at least 50% renewable energy by 2030. So it's there's a lot of reason to be optimistic. The states are what are driving policy. We don't have a federal energy policy in this country. We don't have a federal clean energy policy. But nonetheless, much of the United States looks like Europe. There is a tidal wave of wind and solar that's coming that, you know, in our dark moment, people don't realize it's coming. But in Maryland, offshore wind is coming. We're going to have two offshore wind farms built within 2 years off the coast of Ocean City. Virginia is moving forward with a smaller offshore wind farm and electric cars. I mean, the transition to electric cars is going to happen a lot faster than most people realize. I bought a used Chevy Volt in December for $14,800. You can find them used now online. You can go online and find these cars. I charge my car near the food co-op with free wind power that the city provides. It's happening faster than most people realize.
So we're seeing progressive policies, and also the markets are working in our favor.
Yeah, I mean, no matter what Trump does, he can't make solar prices go up. They continue to go down. Mm-hmm. And that's, again, driven by state policies. Wind power prices are going down. The cost of electric vehicles are going down. Mm-hmm. Elon Musk has shared with the whole world his electric car technology, in part because he said, you know, if we kept this technology to ourselves, we'd have greater market share across the world, but we won't have an earth to live on. We want other companies to use this technology. So electric car manufacturers in China and Detroit are moving forward almost as fast as Tesla. There's greater ambition in the States right now, and a lot of it is because of Donald Trump, and it's because of the science, as you mentioned at the top of the show. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has basically said time's up. Mm-hmm. And so you see states moving faster. Our polling at Chesapeake Climate Action Network, we've done polling in Maryland and Virginia and D.C., that shows that every time Donald Trump says he loves coal, people in this region want more wind power. Every time he says he wants to frack, right, people want to move toward electric cars. It's just, it has the inverse effect that he's hoping for in our region. And that's moving policy. We banned fracking in Maryland in 2017, in large part as a reaction to Donald Trump's election. I'm not sure if he had not become president, we may not have banned fracking by now. So there's a, it's the upside of the downside. It's terrible to have the downside at all. But I remain optimistic that our states are going to move our country in the right direction, so that solar power is so cheap in Mississippi that because of the policies in California and Maryland and other states, that they will put coal out of business for good.
Can you say just a little more about the DC bill? Remind us of the goalposts there and why that is so progressive.
Yeah, it's called the DC Clean Energy Act, and it is arguably the most ambitious climate bill ever passed by any state. It has its own set of utility laws. It's able to do all the things that California or Maryland or other states can do. It is going to require not just building standards for new buildings, but energy efficiency standards for existing buildings. So you're going to see lots of new jobs and weatherization of buildings, homes in the district under this ambitious policy. Again, 100% renewable electricity in the grid in DC by 2032. A fee bait, if you will, for cars, so that if you have an electric car and you're registering it in the District of Columbia, you will pay no excise tax. If you have a Hummer and you register it in the District of Columbia, you're going to pay a lot of an excise tax. It's significant in its own right, but the greater the added value is that we set an example for other states. I think that's what inspires Mary Che and other council members. And Mayor Bowser has said that she wants to be a leader on this. She's gotten awards worldwide. She's gone to Mexico City and to Paris and gotten recognized for her ambitious climate policies. And so I think the council and the mayor are all in on this.
Nice. Really briefly, besides energy, which is this huge piece that we need to reform here, meat eating.
Well, I am a vegetarian because of climate change. I love to eat meat personally. I was born in Memphis, Tennessee, the barbecue capital of the Milky Way galaxy. So it's in my DNA. I really do love to eat slow cooked pig meat, but I don't eat it. And I don't eat any meat or fish. And that's because the climate impacts, the climate intensity, the carbon intensity of meat is extraordinary. You know, it sometimes frustrates me that a lot of my friends in the green movement, you know, will drive an electric car and change all their light bulbs, but will eat meat three times a day. And so their carbon intensity is almost as large as others. One of the number one things people can do in their own lives, in addition to transportation and changing light bulbs, is to eat lower on the food chain, because it takes so much land, so much refrigeration, mm-hmm. so much petrochemicals to grow meat. But frankly, we're not going to convert everyone on that basis. The number one way to reform the carbon intensity of our food consumption in this country is to put a price on carbon. A carbon tax will reflect the hamburger at McDonald's will be $20 and the excellent veggie burger will be $3
right.
once you have a carbon tax. And that's how we're going to reform the food industry.
All right. Let's take a short break. Next up, Mike is an advocacy leader, but in a prior life, he's been an author, a travel writer for National Geographic Traveler. We'll talk about what Mike's seen and how he felt doing that work when we return.
Bullets come down in a railroad train with a little man with a notepad in his hand. Prayers and say, oh, little man, shame what the river has done to this poor cracker's land.
This is Climate Autumn on Tacoma Radio 94.3 FM and streaming live at tacomaradio.org. I'm Julie Hantman, talking with Mike Tidwell still, and he's the director of the local policy organization Chesapeake Climate Action Network, or CCAN. Before your work, you were a travel writer, and did one lead you to the other?
I have always loved traveling, and I, number one, consider myself a writer, you know, long before I was an activist on the environment. In my heart of hearts, I'm a writer, and if it weren't for climate change, I'd just be doing creative writing. But I was lucky enough for years of my career as a freelance print journalist to write a lot of stories for the Sunday travel section of the Washington Post. And I had an editor who years ago told me to go to Louisiana and write whatever I wanted. This was the late 90s. I wound up going and came up with this idea of hitchhiking on Cajun fishing boats up and down the bayous, the slow-moving streams of South Louisiana, just hitchhiking from shrimp boat to oyster boat to crab boat. I'd get to the Gulf of Mexico and then start over on another bayou, and it was just an amazing experience. But as I was spending time with these Cajun fishing people, most of whom speak French better than they speak English, never owned a credit card, never been in an airplane, they were the ones who told me, and this was the late 1990s, they were pointing out the catastrophic land loss that was happening throughout South Louisiana, the marshes disappearing, entire forests drowning in water, cemeteries in old towns in South Louisiana that were literally inundated by water. And they said it's because the land is sinking and the ocean is rising and Katrina is coming. This was the late 90s. They didn't know what to call her, but they said a massive hurricane is going to come and wipe us out because we've lost so much land. I was astounded that a fellow, you know, I was being schooled by these fellow Americans in the bayous of South Louisiana. I didn't know anything about the catastrophic land loss in South Louisiana because we've channeled the Mississippi River and we force all the sediments and nutrients of the Mississippi River off a continental cliff into the deep water of the Gulf of Mexico. That river, which built the ragged sole of the Louisiana boot, never floods like it used to and doesn't replenish the land. And as a result, the land is naturally sinking at the same time that climate change is bringing the water higher. An area of land the size of Manhattan turns to water in South Louisiana every 10 months to this day. And that's why Katrina and these other hurricanes have been so devastating to South Louisiana. So I wound up writing a whole book about this. It came out in 2003. It's called Bayou Farewell, The Rich Life and Tragic Death of Louisiana's Cajun Coast. It sounds like I wrote it after Katrina, but it came out 2 years before Katrina to try to sound the alarm about the unsustainability of our many of our efforts to get nature to heal, to get nature to obey our rules, when in reality, nature always bats last. And that experience did turn me into a climate activist, because as I was writing Bayou Farewell in 2001, 2002, I thought to myself, here's a modern American city, New Orleans and surrounding area, that's committing basically group suicide, because these people down there knew the land was sinking, knew the water was rising, knew Katrina was coming, but weren't doing anything to really protect themselves. And I thought, as I was writing Bayou Farewell, if it's happening here in South Louisiana, where else is it happening? And then that's when I lifted my eyes from my writing table and realized we're all New Orleanians. Because of climate change, the ocean is rising everywhere. Storms are getting more powerful everywhere. And we have to learn from this South Louisiana experience of misusing the Mississippi River, trying to get nature to heal and to obey our unsustainable plans, and instead switch to clean, renewable energy, mimic nature's power in the sun and the wind. And that's what basically led me to found Chesapeake Climate Action Network in 2002. It was my experience hitchhiking on Cajun shrimp boats.
What else have you seen that's either hopeful or interesting when you have done some of your travels in relation to climate change?
Well, I mean, you've got the Dutch, of course, who, you know, a third of Holland is below sea level. Yeah. And they've built some pretty impressive structures there. And they're starting to reflood some of those areas, again, trying to mimic the natural conditions of the major rivers in Holland. But honestly, there have not been enough strides made towards sustainability in this country or in South Louisiana. In Miami and New York, there are high-rise buildings being built right now that are flooding as they're being built. They're flooding because of high tides and climate change and sea level rise as they're being built. So there's a lot to be pessimistic about. Look, we're going to lose a lot from climate change. We've built a lot of infrastructure that's going to be stranded. There are parts of Norfolk, Virginia right now where the city has basically said no new building in this entire part of the city because we know that within 50 years, this part of the city will be permanently underwater. And so there is a planned retreat underway in places like Norfolk. Unfortunately, I think we're going to have to retreat from a good large part of many of our coastal cities, not just in America, but worldwide. But as the recent scientific report made clear, if we make this rapid pivot, and I mean right. really rapid pivot to clean energy, we can avoid the worst impacts of sea level rise and larger storms. But we are out of time. We got to get going.
Real quick, you loved traveling. Do you travel now?
You know, I travel some for work. I really try to avoid flying. I really do. I don't sign up for any kind of frequent flyer flying programs, so I don't have any incentives to do extra flying. There's a great billboard outside of Richmond, Virginia that I saw the other day that basically describes what I like to do in terms of travel, and it says, explore the great nearby. There are so many amazing places. I mean, I was hiking in Great Falls just last Saturday, and I thought, Why do I need to go to the Rockies, man? There's so many great things. I hiked the Appalachian Trail. Mm-hmm. I used the Potomac River. I kayak. I fish in the Potomac. So I try to explore the great nearby and reduce my carbon footprint in terms of travel that way.
Awesome. Let's take another break. And next up is Jill Cubitt from Dear Tomorrow, and we'll read some letters to the future.
When the one that left us, yeah, turns for us at last, we are but a moment's sunlight fading in the grass. Come on, people, now smile on your brother. Everybody get together, try to love one another.
I'm Julie Hantman, and this is Climate Autumn on Tacoma Radio 94.3 FM and streaming live at tacomaradio.org. And I'm talking now with Jill Cubitt, the co-founder and director of Dear Tomorrow, a project that encourages people to write letters to tomorrow. Jill, can you explain the project and what led you to create it and what are its goals, all that stuff?
So the idea of Dear Tomorrow is actually a very simple concept. It is, if we think about climate change in the context of somebody that we care about, someone we love, or in our own legacy, we are more motivated to take action. And so what we ask people to do is to imagine someone that they love, their child or grandchild, or maybe even their future self, standing in the year 2050 and looking back on us today, and they are asking us, what are we doing about climate change? So then the person who is writing or participating is taking time to really think and reflect about what kinds of actions they're taking, how they think about climate change, and really what are their hopes and their visions for a more sustainable future. And they're taking the time to write this down and participate in our project. And then they have the opportunity to share that story with their friends, family, and social networks. What we're really trying to do is take a concept that is really difficult, like climate change feels very overwhelming to people, it's very distant, it's highly politicized, and we're trying to reframe it in terms of connecting it to what we already care about, our own values and our own identities, our identities as people, as parents, as community members, and to really kind of shift the conversation of how we think about and how we talk about climate change. Mm-hmm. This project came out of my experience of working in the climate movement. I worked from 2006 to 2013 specifically with the trade union movement on climate change. And through that work, I did lots of trainings and leadership development and organizing work. And a lot of the work that I was doing was very kind of intellectual, policy driven, talking about difficult scientific facts and kind of conveying information in that way. And after doing it for a while, you know, for about 8 years, I really felt that most people in, you know, that I was working with, but kind of across the general public, most people don't really have a kind of a deep connection to the issue of climate change. And so I, you know, I took some time off. I went to graduate school, and at about the same time, I had a child. And the process of bringing a child into the world and knowing about climate change completely shifted how I thought about the issue. And it really moved from thinking about it in a very kind of intellectual way mm-hmm. to something that was very personal, very immediate. And I just had this very transformative personal experience working on the issue. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I thought if we can kind of take that and communicate climate change in a much more the kind of emotional, personal way, we can really make a difference.
And then the people who write the letters can share it with family and friends. And then, of course, you are also sharing the letters, which we're about to do here. So let's read a letter from Tennessee mom and activist Lindsay Pace. And for that, we will turn to Marika, who's right here at the controls, and she will read that letter from Lindsay Pace.
Thank you, Julie. This letter written by Lindsay Pace for her daughter, Gray. Dear Gray, today you ran up to me, arms wide open, with a purple violet in your hand. You said, Mama, it called to me. And at the age of 2, you have a deep connection with nature. We live at the base of a mountain, and you love to explore in the dense, biodiverse Appalachian forest. I hope you continue to be a friend to plants, as you like to say. I'm deeply aware that the world you will be living in when you're an adult will be a harsher, more inhospitable world for plants. But more importantly, it's going to be a harsher world to live in for you. I've been involved in the movement to halt climate change for over a decade. I became involved when I saw the destruction of our beautiful Appalachian Mountains, the oldest mountain chain in the world, was being blown apart for coal. Huge craters of sorrow were left in its wake. There had to be a better way to get energy without requiring so much sacrifice. We have the solutions in front of us. The technology is here. We know the answer is to replace polluting fossil fuels with clean energy, yet it takes time. As I sit here in this 90-degree Tennessee spring, I try not to get frustrated by how much time we've already lost. When you were born, I promised you that I would protect you from the little dangers of every day, like your 2-year-old need to climb on everything, but also from the big overarching dangers that will impact your life, like climate change. I don't know what your world will look like when you're reading this letter. How much habitat loss has happened, how many natural disasters you've seen, how much scarcity over natural resources you've faced. I hope it's minimal. When I asked you why the purple violet called to you, you told me it was magic. I hope you can still find the magic of life. I hope despite everything, it is still in abundance. I will never stop fighting for you, for your world, for your health, for your happiness. You are worth every effort, and every child is. That's all my love, Mama.
Thank you, Marika. There were so many feelings brought up in that letter. And as a mother of a young child myself, you know, do you have any thoughts that you want to share? Any of the panelists really, or especially Jill, around that letter?
Well, that letter actually had a profound impact on me when it was written. Mostly because that was one of the first letters that was written where I really, when I first read it, I kind of sat down and like had tears kind of streaming down my face. And it was one of the letters that I really felt that people were willing to share very deeply, very thoughtful pieces. And for us as, you know, as an organization, it wasn't just me writing or other people who were working on the team. You know, it was other people who were out there who were working on climate. And so it was like a milestone pass where we could actually see that this project could really work. And so it's very important to us.
Right. Let's go into a short version of another letter from a dad named Ryan Wilson. I'm going to turn it to Mike Tidwell, who's offered to read this letter again, written by Ryan Wilson to his two children.
Yeah, so this is written by Ryan Wilson to his two children, Seamus and Tuva. Dear Seamus and Tuva, as you remember, Mama and I encourage you to be stewards of the earth, but really, you came onto the planet with forceful ideas about our environment and all life. There are a few days that go by that I don't think about the unbelievable collective denial from which human beings are still consciously suffering. It scares the heck out of me that so many people are aware of the now irreparable damage we've done and still choose to act as though, via magic, all catastrophes in the future simply will not happen. What are Mama and I doing about it? You remember how it is. We can't afford an electric car, nor do we have a space to charge one. So we burn the earth's blood and feel really bad about it. But you also remember that we live very simply. True, we don't have many options, living month to month under the strain of massive debt, but we have found much greater happiness in truly preferring a small place, a simple life of enjoying each other. I hope this first intentional way of life is what you remember, that living for the enjoyment of your family, friends, your talents, your work in the world, for the world, is the place to put your energy. Living with that purpose cannot possibly leave the earth worse than you found it. Leave it better, cleaner, more aware, more alive, and that's really it, the camper's old code. I hope with all my heart that you both have the option, the luxury, the privilege to look out on the world and ask yourselves, what do I want to do? And then do it. I love you so much. Love, Papa.
That really speaks to how I felt. Also wondering whether my child's career and all sorts of things will change. What will be her future?
Yeah, I really feel a sense of really thinking deeply about what's really important in life. And I think that comes through in the letter, this kind of perhaps more simple life where we share experiences, where we value time, where we value relationships with others. And I think those are things that we're all going to have to think about, is what does make a really good life. And the way a good life has been defined in the past, you know, often has to do with the things you can buy. And one of the, I think, the big shifts that will need to happen culturally is redefining what it means to lead a very fulfilling life.
This reminds me of the film by Josh Fox a few years ago, How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things That Climate Can't Change. And it's a very touching film. It comes out of the climate movement, but it's very accessible. And I would suggest listeners try to check that out. So at this time, we can take another quick break. Next up, we'll talk with visual artist Noelle Kasowitz about her very cool art project.
Your children are not your children. They are the sons and the daughters of life, longing for itself. They come through you, but they are not from you. And though they are with you, they belong not to you. You can give them your love, but not your thoughts. For they have their own thoughts. They have their own thoughts.
This is Climate Autumn on Tacoma Radio, 94.3 FM, and streaming live at tacomaradio.org. And I'm Julie Hantman. I am certainly extraordinarily grateful to Tacoma Radio for giving me a platform for doing this work. You just don't see enough comprehensive coverage of climate change, and we are doing it here for a whole hour. I don't think you will get that anywhere else. So thank you, Marika, and everybody. And thanks to my guests for showing up and making this happen. As I said, I'm going to talk to now DC-based artist Noelle Kasowitz. Hello, Noelle.
Hi, Julie.
You've been sitting here very patiently.
I've loved hearing everything so far. It's been an amazing conversation.
Awesome. And we might move a little more quickly through your project and then get to the conversation. Is that all right? Okay. Noelle, you were born and raised in Miami, right?
Yes.
Raised there too. Okay. And it seems like you moved to DC to raise some hell. Is that right? I read your stuff.
I love it. Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Your project is the Floating Painting Project.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Can you tell us about it and what led you to it?
Absolutely. Yeah, well, today we are facing unprecedented levels of chaos with our climate. And while there are so many ways that the change is occurring, one most concerning for me as an artist and Miami native is rising sea levels. At this rate, how will works, artworks, that are supposed to last hundreds of years even make it to 20? So frustrated by society's perpetual apathy and desperate to give my paintings a fighting chance, I began researching various ways to make my paintings climate change ready.
Climate change ready. Okay.
Absolutely. Cool. And so in doing that, I consulted with an expert in the field of art conservation. I taught myself how to weave my own canvas, and as I did that, embed different found buoys and other flotation devices into the fabric of my paintings. As exemplified in my ongoing series, They Say Hope Floats, But I'd Rather Be Sure. Mm-hmm. I have also tried other approaches, such as playfully wrapping existing paintings in common pool noodles, to making more complex waterproof paintings from synthetic sailcloth and marine foam.
Wow. That's so cool. In August, you floated down down the Potomac River on one of these.
I did.
Works of art. That was very cool. And I saw that it wasn't just like you're saying, my art needs to be protected. You were also dressed as an art collector. Is that right? So the image is of someone who has just had to flee her home and the river has risen and she's saving her painting.
Exactly. So with my works, you know, when I make them, the result is a painting that can float up and off its walls to save itself in a flooding situation. But some of my larger works are big enough to double as a raft and mm-hmm. save you as well. And certainly I embed humor into my work because I hope to sneak through the wall of apathy that has currently built up around the issue of climate change. Right. And I found my Trojan horse is art with a satirical sense of humor. Right. And humor catches people off guard. You know, a lot of times I'm able to spark conversations with people otherwise reluctant to engage with the topic. So yes, for my own amusement, I imagine someday in the flooded future, an art collector will be sitting safely atop of their floating artwork, exclaiming, thank goodness we bought a Noel Kasowitz.
Oh, totally. So what's next? Are you doing any more floats?
I am. I have several projects. Living in D.C., I've been here just under 2 years now. One of my goals is to work with many of the embassies and international organizations that have a presence here as a way of amplifying this global issue. And another goal, being positioned somewhat centrally along it, is to travel up and down the eastern seaboard to communities that will be or already are, we mentioned Norfolk, for instance, facing rising sea levels. And in doing this, I hope to highlight how abstract global issues affect us on the local level, a level that people are typically more emotionally connected with. And then later on, I'll also be down in Miami and Key West this December to film some of the video pieces that accompany this project.
So cool. And lastly, I'll just briefly say, I've thought for a long time that everyone in every sector, every profession has to start thinking about how it's going to affect them. So it's sort of like your sector is art and you're saying, what will happen to the art that I have or that I sell to people? Yeah. And every sector would seem should do the same thing.
Exactly. It's the fact that if the artists are having to prepare, maybe the rest of us need to as well.
You know, exactly. So let's bring Jill back in. And Mike, you're an artist too. So, you know, feel free to join in. You know, let's just break this out. And this is sort of like the last piece of our hour. Some unorthodox means of communicating have been discussed today. Writing letters to the future, floating on your artwork. Are there other innovators out there?
I can name several visual artists. Eve Mosher had a wonderful project called High Waterline that she did in New York in 2007 and then Miami in 2013, where it was a miles-long project of chalking the climate change-predicted high waterline throughout cities to raise awareness as she walked through the different communities. Besides that, there's Olafur Eliasson, who did this wonderful piece called Ice Watch in 2014, where he took 12 immense blocks of ice that broke off the Greenland ice sheet and placed them right in the middle of a city so that people would interact with them and watch in real time as they melted. And then right now, even in New York, there's an artist, Justin Bryce Grigula, who has a climate signals project that uses construction warning signs, but he has manipulated the wording to give us instead climate warning signals. And that's currently up right now, I think for a few more weeks, and it's worth checking out.
That's so huge, to mm-hmm. make it really participatory and in your face. You know?
Exactly.
And that's what it needs to be. Go ahead, Jill.
I live in New York, and I had the opportunity to go down to the Climate Museum and see some of that work. And also they had a participatory piece of it where people could write their own message. It's a really important part of art, is trying to figure out how to not just present the work, but how to then create a way for people to actually engage with it. A lot of the solutions that have been put forward and a lot of the strategy has been around changing policy or around technical solutions. Mm-hmm. And there hasn't been really a focus on kind of the social aspect or the behavioral pieces. And so I think there's room now to kind of open up that conversation, because the science tells us we have to make, you know, this massive transformation. And we really need people to be part of that conversation. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I love your work. This is great. This is really amazing, because it's not enough for people to change. They need more than data. They need to just have more than just information. They have to be inspired, and they have to feel it. And I think that's what art does. That's what great oratory, great paintings, just the creative spirit is what will save us, I think, ultimately. You know, the human civilization dates back about 10,000 years ago. No coincidence that our Earth started to stabilize in terms of its climate, and the current Holocene period began about 10,000 years ago. So our climate gave way to civilization, and for people to be able to do things other than just grow food and hunt and gather, we were able to think and contemplate and create. And I worry about that. It, you know, climate is destiny. If we change our climate, we change our destiny. And if we lose our civilization, then we lose this great art, these great traditions. And I think art will continue to play a big role in inspiring us to do better on this issue. So I really appreciate your work.
Thank you so much. I love that line about destiny. Could you say that one more time, just so everyone heard it?
Climate is destiny. If we change our climate, we change our destiny.
That's amazing.
I was just wondering, Jill and Noella, if you feel like your work is working.
Well, certainly with my work, it's been a series that I've only been working on for about the last couple of years, but more and more as I continue to get it out in different exhibitions or art fairs or whatever kind of public forum introduces it to people, the conversations have been amazing that have taken part of it, you know, and I feel like I've met people on all sides of the aisle of the issue. And I think some of my favorite conversations have been the ones with people who weren't exactly believers of my topic, you know, and then just engaging in that conversation felt so worthwhile. And I don't know. What about you, Jill?
Well, we're trying to really empower people who already care to create their own stories and then to really share them. And so, you know, we've heard from people that by writing, they've been able to kind of deepen their commitment, and it's been easier for them to have conversations with, you know, their friends or their family, where before they weren't willing to do that. And so, you know, I think on the individual level and also organizationally, there's a lot of community organizations and schools and places. They want to do this kind of creative work. They want creative work. They want narrative work. Nice. They want art.
I wish we could keep going, but I want to thank my guests, Mike Tidwell, and you can check out his website, ChesapeakeClimate.org, Jill Cubitt, DearTomorrow.org, and Noelle Kasowitz, that's spelled K-A-S-S-E-W-I-T-Z, and it's NoelleKasowitz.org, or you just follow her at #ArtistAdrift, which I love. And I want to thank Tacoma Radio once again, and stay tuned. Just like that, do it.